We're talking about the highly toxic chemicals known by the acronym PFAS. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Tony Evers' recent budget proposal calls for taking steps to get a handle on these man-made synthetic compounds that are toxic and widespread in our environment. Phoebe Petrovic has been reporting on the confusion around PFAS in the state. She's the Lee Esther News Fellow at Wisconsin Public Radio. Phoebe, thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we know these are man-made, but help us get a better grasp of what PFAS are.
Yeah, so PFAS is an umbrella term for 3,000 to 4,000 different chemicals, so it covers a lot. And at the molecular level, what they do is they're sort of non-stick compounds. So what you'll find is that they're often used in things like non-stick cookware, or if you have a rain jacket that repels water, fabric that repels grease or stains, pizza boxes. So it's in everything from food packaging to clothing to also then firefighting foam. They've been in use since the 1940s, so they've been around for decades. The industry has sort of voluntarily phased them out, according to the EPA, but they don't tend to break down once they're in the environment, and so they're pretty widespread.
So they're not breaking down in the environment. What is known about what these compounds do?
Yeah, so if you are exposed to PFAS, they can build up over time. They don't break down in your body, and they can cause some adverse health risks. So we know from scientific literature that the two most common compounds especially, have been linked to cancer. They've been linked to thyroid problems, immune deficiencies, developmental or reproductive problems, high cholesterol. So the science is still sort of developing, but we know that they do pose a risk.
And so there are thousands under this one umbrella, and we use this acronym PFAS. Of these compounds, what are the most common? Which ones do we know most about?
So we know the most about the most common, which are these two. That's PFOA and PFOS. And these are the ones that, because they occur in the environment most frequently, those are the ones that have been studied the most. So that's what we have the most scientific basis for. And these two are the ones that are currently addressed by the EPA. They have the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has what's called a lifetime health advisory for individual or combined amounts of PFOA and PFOS. That's of 70 parts per trillion. So they say if you're drinking water over that, it's unsafe. But the problem is there are, as we said, there are thousands of these chemicals. About 30 or so are being studied right now. But we know that probably these other ones pose a risk as well. When you test water, like in, say, Madison, you show up with 10 of these compounds. Only two of them are covered by federal regulations. But that doesn't mean that that is comprehensive or reflective of the true risk.
WPR's Phoebe Petrovic is with us as we talk about her recent article surrounding the confusion over PFAS in Wisconsin. These are the toxic synthetic chemicals that have been used for decades in consumer products and industry. They're widely present in the environment. Phoebe, what kind of regulation exists for PFAS at this time in Wisconsin?
So currently, Wisconsin doesn't have its own statewide regulation for PFAS. Instead, what we do is we defer to the federal EPA's lifetime health advisory for the two main compounds. That said, the DNR does have the ability to order sort of a person or a company that's at fault for spilling PFAS into the environment and creating them. They have the right to order them to clean up and go through remediation to provide people who are affected with bottled water, maybe well filters, things like that. So Wisconsin is, however, currently working on developing a statewide regulation of their own for these most common two, PFOA, PFOS, which again are the ones that are covered under that EPA umbrella right now. The DHS is working on that. The Department of Health Services, by the request of the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, we're expecting to get that sometime mid this year, so probably in the summer. And we know that the DNR also has a list of about 20 additional PFAS compounds on their own list that they plan to ask the DHS to look at eventually, once they're done with this current cycle, it's sort of closed for looking right now. And what the DHS tells me that they're doing is really digging into the scientific literature that exists on these compounds to make sure that they're developing a standard that is scientifically valid and sufficiently protective and safe.
And we're really concerned about drinking water and wells all across Wisconsin, especially with nitrates. What do we know about PFAS in drinking water?
Yeah, so we know that that's one of the places that people get exposed to PFAS the most. The other most common way that you're exposed is if you're eating fish, say, who have been swimming in a pond or a lake that has these compounds in it, then you can get the contamination that way. But again, this 70 parts per trillion federal regulation by the EPA, or health advisory rather, that's mostly for drinking water. And so we're saying that you shouldn't drink water that's over that threshold. And, you know, if you do get exposed to it, once it's in your body, it just accumulates and it doesn't break down.
We've learned that PFAS have been found at the former Badger Army Ammunition Plant in Sauk County. What do we know there? What happened?
So the former Badger Army Ammunition Plant has been going through a redevelopment and remediation since the 1990s. So we know that there's a ton of chemicals there. Small amounts of PFAS have been detected in the groundwater, some in the surface water, I believe. And these were detected by the Army in May of 2018. However, the DNR is careful to say that because they're low amounts, they don't believe that the Army is actually at fault for this, because we would expect that Army activities would mean that it's much higher. However, the Army detected about 6 PFAS chemicals or PFAS compounds. The Army detected about 6 PFAS compounds with an accumulated combined amount of 82 parts per trillion. And when they reported on these results at a public meeting back in November of 2018, they only mentioned 2. And they said PFOA and PFOS, which again are the ones covered under the EPA, these were found at 19.5 parts per trillion. Later, someone who, Laura Ola, who runs the Citizens for Safe Water around Badger, she requested the full data from the Army and found, hey, you guys actually found 6 of these compounds and the total is 82.5. So the Army says, we didn't do anything wrong by not disclosing that information, because our first priority is to follow the EPA guideline and making sure that people aren't drinking water that's in excess of that. But, you know, people like Laura Ola say, we should know everything that's in our water. If you found this information, we should know. We don't actually know whether or not that water is safe.
As we wrap up, how has Governor Tony Evers wanted to put some handle on this? Because this is part of his budget proposal.
Yeah, I mean, so we know that Governor Tony Evers has made 2019 the year of clean drinking water. And so PFAS are certainly a part of that. So he has asked for a small amount of money to start looking into this. So $150,000 to create a strategy for determining what sites in the state have contamination. The DNR lists 16 open sites that are currently being redeveloped right now, but we know that that's certainly not the full extent of it. And he's also asked for $50,000 to survey first responders to see if they use PFAS-containing firefighting foam, because that's often one place where we find them.
Well, Phoebe, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Phoebe Petrovic reports for Wisconsin Public Radio as the Lee Esther News Fellow. We've been talking about Wisconsin's approach to investigating the highly toxic synthetic chemicals that go by the acronym PFAS, along with possible next steps at the state and federal levels. To learn more about these compounds and what's happening with them in Wisconsin, head to the Morning Show page at WPR.org to find links to our recent coverage. Coming up, Kohler Company recently announced it will shut down its engine operations plant in Sheboygan County and move hundreds of jobs to Mississippi. We'll look at industry trend lines in manufacturing, both in the Midwest and here in Wisconsin. Kohler says it's fully committed to its headquarters in the state, and we want to hear from you. Are you a current employee with Kohler who will face a job change? Do you work in manufacturing, and have you seen consolidation shifts in your sector of the industry? Have you ever moved to keep your job? Do you hope to find a job in manufacturing in the state but are dissuaded by job moves out of Wisconsin? You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us as we discuss bath and kitchen giant Kohler here on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. We're talking about Kohler Company moving jobs on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kohler says it's committed to Sheboygan County and its headquarters here in Wisconsin. And here in the state, it employs about 7,900 full and part-time workers with approximately 2,100 in manufacturing. This kitchen and bath products giant plays an outsized role in our economy and the economy of Sheboygan County. We're looking closer at this news that Kohler is shifting hundreds of jobs to Mississippi as it consolidates its small engines division. Are you a current employee with Kohler who faces a job change? Do you anticipate lost income? Kohler says it's creating alternative jobs. What are your options? We're at 800-642-1234. Tim Bartik is a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He studies how local and state policies impact economic development, and he also researches how government incentives affect decisions of corporate manufacturing. Tim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on.
So this news out of Kohler last week, moving engine production to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Can you tell us why Mississippi might be a better place, better suited to manufacture engines?
Well, I can't, you know, read Kohler's mind and know exactly what drove this decision. I do think some people fit this into some stereotype they have that all U.S. manufacturing in any high-wage location is doomed, that it's all going to low-wage southern locations or all going to China or whatever. And that's not really the current trend. I mean, manufacturing U.S. really got hammered from 2000 to roughly the depths of the Great Recession. And since then, there's been a big rebound, and that includes a rebound in many northern and midwestern cities. Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is just up the road from where I live, about an hour away, has seen very robust manufacturing growth. Detroit area, actually, in manufacturing is doing very well. Many northern and midwestern cities are doing very well. Now, in Kohler's case, who knows? I mean, from the news reports, it looks as if the wages they will pay in Mississippi will be somewhat lower than the wages paid in Wisconsin. Was that a factor? I don't know.
Quite a bit, Laura. I mean, Kohler employees there make around $16 an hour, which is much less than its Wisconsin employees that are around $26, $27.
Right, but apparently they're going to be paying the workers in the engine facility in Mississippi more than they're paying their current workers. At least that's what the claim is. I don't know if that's true or not, but the news reports said they were going to be paid $45,000 a year, which would be $22, $23 per hour for the engine production in Mississippi. So yeah, wages may have played a factor, but in general, have higher wage places been able to be competitive? They've been able to be competitive by having higher skills. In certain segments of manufacturing, simply having low wages isn't enough. The skills become more important. I mean, essentially, a lot of the really low wage manufacturing, the U.S. has already lost to China or other lower wage locations. And what remains are manufacturing where there's a premium having very high skills. And so if places like Sheboygan or like Wisconsin in general want to compete for manufacturing, trying to beat the rest of the world on low wages is not really a workable strategy. You need to compete on other things like having hopefully really good infrastructure, really good skills. And that's the area where the U.S. can be competitive.
So do we know how is Kohler doing? We know that this consolidation, they said, will create a simplified customer experience. It's not about reducing headcount. But at a time when some sectors of manufacturing aren't perhaps doing as well, what do we know about Kohler and is kitchen and bath industry profitable?
Well, I'm not an expert in the kitchen and bath industry, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask about that. I mean, I think that in general, I mean, I think manufacturing is not something that people should write off as the jobs of the past. Manufacturing includes the jobs of the future, but they're going to be different kind of manufacturing jobs. There aren't going to be as many manufacturing jobs that don't require some type of skill credentials, not necessarily four-year college degrees, but they're going to require some kind of skill credentials through community college. I think in Wisconsin you call them technical colleges. They're going to require more skills than manufacturing jobs in the past. maybe have required, or at least more credentials, more formal skills development than have been the case in the past.
We're talking about Wisconsin manufacturing in light of the Kohler Company's recent changes. Tim Bartik is an economist who studies how local and state policies impact economic development. Wisconsin has nearly 461,000 manufacturing jobs in the state. Are you one of them? What is your job, and what are your thoughts about moving Kohler positions out of state? How do you feel about the role of unions in the Kohler negotiation and the end result? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tim, it's been reported that Kohler will receive more than $18.5 million in tax breaks and subsidies by manufacturing in Mississippi. How does Wisconsin compare to other states in the U.S. when it comes to corporate incentives?
Wisconsin traditionally has been about average in the last few years in what it offers. I mean, the typical incentive that Wisconsin offers, one way of putting it, it's roughly equivalent to giving a company a 3% wage subsidy for 20 years. That's about average for the U.S. Now, you know, things like Foxconn, all the rules were thrown out, and Foxconn was offered a subsidy of 30% of wages. And, of course, that project, I don't think anyone has any idea where that project's going right now. But but generally, Wisconsin, you know, has been quite competitive in the incentive picture. As I said, 3% of wages for 20 years is not a trivial subsidy. That does significantly lower cost, and it is enough. So on the margin, it plays some role in location decisions. I mean, incentives are not the overwhelming factor. I mean, if you're not competitive on other factors, incentives are not going to make a bad location into a good location.
Yeah, what other types of incentives can states highlight when they're trying to attract large employers?
Well, what I've argued, I think, is that actually states can do more if instead of spending all their money on tax incentives. I mean, tax incentives are easier to do. I mean, you know, handing companies cash, it's popular, people like it. It's easy to do. It's easy to design. A more complicated kind of incentive is, for example, promising companies you're going to help train their workers, which is a little more complicated to deliver, but the evidence suggests that actually has a higher bang for the buck. A little more complicated also is making sure your infrastructure is in place, making sure that you have good industrial sites that are zoned properly, that have the utilities, that have the road access, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually think you have a higher bang for the buck from making sure you have land that's suitable for industrial development with the right zoning, the right utilities, and you have your technical college system, your community college system set up to provide trained workers for the company. Because, you know, what companies really want is they want to know that they can get into production quickly at a site that's suitable and they can find workers.
Well, let's take a moment here and look at the recent Amazon headquarters search. The company chose New York City, then pulled out. It was messy. There were protests in the community. They're sticking with Arlington, Virginia, but the incentives there were not apples to apples. So what do you see there?
Well, it's interesting because the two sites that they were both cases they were promising to put about 40,000 jobs. 40,000 jobs in New York, 40,000 jobs in Northern Virginia. New York offered them $3 billion. Northern Virginia offered them about $700 million, about one quarter as much. But what Virginia did is, as part of their incentive package, if you want to call it that, is they said, we're going to do a number of things. We're going to make some road improvements in the area, some improvements in the metro transit system, the mass transit system. And Virginia Tech, we're going to locate a new facility of Virginia Tech in Northern Virginia that will provide trained software engineers. Now, you can view that as an incentive. I mean, it's definitely something that makes Northern Virginia more attractive for Amazon. They know they're going to be able to get these software engineers out of this Virginia Tech college. On the other hand, even if Amazon, I mean, who knows? Maybe Amazon won't be around 10 years from now. Economy changes all the time. Even if Amazon doesn't pan out the way Virginia hopes, presumably that Virginia Tech facility will really help attract other high-tech companies to the Northern Virginia area. So I think that the package that Virginia put together was a much smarter type of package, and it probably resulted in less public backlash because you weren't simply giving the company cash. You were providing infrastructure improvements and training improvements that would benefit people in Northern Virginia more broadly.
We're taking the pulse on manufacturing industry trends here in Wisconsin as Kohler Company decides to consolidate its small engines division in Mississippi, moving hundreds of jobs from its headquarters here in Wisconsin. Tim Bartik is our guide. He's a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So what are your thoughts about moving Kohler positions out of state? How do you feel about the role of unions in this negotiation and what you saw in the end result? Are you working in Wisconsin manufacturing? How do you see the job climate here? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the discussion after a news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're checking in on manufacturing in Wisconsin as Kohler Company announced it will be moving hundreds of jobs from Wisconsin to Mississippi, consolidating its small engines division. We've learned that most of the engine division workers will go to Kohler's generators, faucets, and cast iron divisions. And we've also learned Kohler plans to provide all affected workers with different jobs in Sheboygan. They employ about 7,900 full and part-time workers here. Do you know someone who works in manufacturing? What is their position? How has the industry helped or hurt them? And do you see consolidation moves elsewhere in Wisconsin manufacturing? What do you think about Kohler's decision and the way they're handling the job shifts for the Wisconsin workers? We're at 800-642-1234. Economist Tim Bartik is our guide. He's based at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Michigan. Let's go straight to the phones now with Alan joining us from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. Thank you. So I worked for a Wisconsin company installing equipment at a Caterpillar plant about 5 years ago down in Athens, Georgia. And the guy that was installing the water filtration system told me specifically that that water filtration system did not actually filter the water. All it did was dilute the chemicals. So it was diluted enough that it was legal to dump down the drain. Now, the other thing you have to look at is companies or states down south are getting rid of their workers' compensation laws to protect workers. And this also, this whole deal of giving somebody a tax break so they can move in there and suck resources out of the community is a race to the bottom. We're going the wrong way.
Alan, you bring up a number of points here, starting, though, with pollution and environmental impact. Tim?
Well, in general, I think that, you know, there have been studies. Environmental regulations have some effect on business locations, not an overwhelming effect, and I certainly don't think it's enough that states and local areas need to feel that they need to destroy their environment to attract jobs. In other words, you have to decide what are you aiming at in economic development. Hopefully you're aiming at a better quality of life for everyone in the community. It's not really worth it if you destroy the local environment in the process. And the reality is that you can't compete without for jobs without necessarily going for companies that are going to destroy the local environment. There are plenty of companies that want to operate more responsibly, create good jobs, and be environmental stewards. And you don't need to pursue every company that might do unethical things or damage the local environment.
Well, what about right-to-work laws? What comparisons have been made between manufacturing growth in states with right-to-work laws and states without?
Well, the evidence there is very mixed. I mean, there really isn't very strong evidence because for most of the history of these, there were just certain states right-to-work and certain states non-right-to-work. There no doubt are some companies that want to avoid unions. and things like right-to-work laws may affect their location decisions. On the other hand, there's considerable evidence that not having a right-to-work law by making it a little bit easier to organize unions raises wages not only at unionized plants but also at non-unionized facilities that, given a little bit more threat of a union being formed, it might increase the wage there to some extent. So there may be some trade-off in the sense that, yes, if you go to right to work, you might attract a few more jobs from companies that want to avoid unions. On the other hand, it may have some adverse effect on wages. I should say, though, in general, there's not huge evidence on this because, as I said, there are only a few states and only in quite recent years that have actually switched the right to work status. And it's not clear as of yet what impact that has had overall in the state economy.
Matt from Wausau sent us an email saying that Kohler, like other manufacturing companies, is putting profits ahead of people. He feels that Kohler has an antagonistic relationship with unions. He says, as evidenced by the thousands of dollars Kohler gave to former Governor Scott Walker, whose Act 10 gutted the unions. So what do we know about how the labor unions have been representing manufacturing?
Well, labor unions advocate for their workers. They try to increase wages and benefits at the company. And I don't think they still play a strong role in many manufacturing companies. But one of the booming areas right now in manufacturing is many auto-related places are booming, and they obviously have a very strong union. So there obviously are many more factors that affect economies than whether or not a company has a union.
Let's go to Jeremy now, joining us from Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the difficult things to get our younger generation involved in the manufacturing practices by going to get a technical diploma, tool and die makers, things like that, is because manufacturing companies are too unreliable for longevity jobs. You will go through all that training and only see your job being outsourced 10 years later. And maybe you might get shuffled around within the company, but you're going to work in a position that pays far less than what you're educated to do. And this has been a trend for decades. When I was young back in the 90s, it was going on then, and it continues on to this day. So in a sense, manufacturing has been shooting themselves in the foot for so many years, trying to get skilled tradesmen to work for them, but people don't want to take the time anymore because there's too many uncertainties whether or not that job will be there 10, 15, 20 years from now.
So what can education systems do, Tim Bartik, to keep up with production and technology?
Well, I actually think that I think the caller raised a really good point, which is that it really is more than what the education system alone can do. We need to have, obviously, a good technical college system that prepares people for a variety of careers, including in manufacturing. But what the caller brings up is that if manufacturing is seen as an unstable industry that you can't count on long term, you're working against some pretty powerful forces in trying to encourage people to invest in skills development. Why should I invest in skills development if it's not going to pay off? And, you know, that depends on having some government policy that at least tries to stabilize manufacturing employment. Now, I think that's quite feasible. We got really hammered from 2000 to 2010 in manufacturing. But if we have the right policies in the U.S., I think the U.S. can continue to be competitive in a wide variety of manufacturing industries. I mean, look at Germany. Germany has high wages. German manufacturing has done very well. They don't do well by having low wages. They do well by having high skills. And again, the parts of the U.S. where the manufacturing is doing better are doing better by investing in skills. And if we can keep the U.S. exchange rate reasonable, and then I think the U.S. And keep on developing skills, and I think the U.S. can be quite competitive. But you need to have a government policy that's committed to at least stabilizing the number of manufacturing jobs in the U.S.
We're discussing the current and future state of manufacturing with economist Tim Bartik at our side. He researches how government incentives affect decisions of corporate manufacturing. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the practice of government incentives? Does it always have to be money? What else can legislatures do to attract employers to your area? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, Wisconsin leaders, they look to manufacturing when they talk about growing our state's economy. But is investing in manufacturing perhaps not the right thing? Should we instead be focusing on tech industry or new industry or perhaps growing some mom and pops that are already here?
Well, I think you should have a portfolio of economic development. I mean, you, it's not an either or. I mean, yes, you should. The answer to should you invest in those various things, the answer is yes. You should invest in smaller businesses. You should help people start their business. You should have small business development centers. You should do that. You should also have invest in your manufacturing extension centers that work with small and medium-sized manufacturers, help them find new customers, help them make their operations more productive, help them upgrade the skills of their workforce. Should you invest in high tech? Well, yes, if in fact you have some competitive advantage in that high tech area. I mean, Wisconsin has, you know, one of the premier state universities, one of universities in the world in UW-Madison. You need to try to exploit that. So, I think that Wisconsin should do all those things and have a portfolio of policies. You shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket.
But is traditional manufacturing getting too big a piece of the pie?
I haven't looked in detail at Wisconsin's current economic development policies to be able to say, but the, you know, manufacturing can still be competitive. I mean, even if a certain segment is, if let's say you're doing some manufacturing where you're either bending metal or shaping plastic to go into autos. If autos goes down, you can also bend metal or shape plastic to go into medical instruments if medical instruments is doing better. So some of the skills involved in manufacturing are quite transferable across a wide variety of products. And, the fact that one particular industry may be doing poorly during a particular period doesn't mean that with the right assistance, you can't adapt those skills to producing goods for another industry that may be doing better. So, you know, I don't think the U.S. should give up on manufacturing. Over time, with developing more automation, more robots, et cetera, a wide variety of U.S. places can be competitive in manufacturing, but the remaining jobs are going to require higher skills.
We're getting a read on the health of Wisconsin manufacturing here in the morning show. Tim Bartek digs with us. He's the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Michigan, economist there. Gathering your thoughts and questions along the way at 800-642-1234. What incentives do you think the state should focus on to keep manufacturing here in Wisconsin? Do you see other manufacturers making consolidation moves like Kohler, or do you see firms expanding their manufacturing footprint in Wisconsin? What is the state of the industry from your vantage point? Join in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin manufacturing and industry trends here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin manufacturers account for nearly 18% of the total output in our state, employing about 16% of our labor force. We're examining recent news out of Kohler and Sheboygan County that the luxury plumbing fixtures giant is shifting several hundred jobs to Mississippi, consolidating its small engines division. So what do you see happening in manufacturing in your community? Do you see contraction or expansion? And if you work in manufacturing, are you feeling stable right now or uncertainty? Call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Bartek stays with us as our guide. He is a Kalamazoo, Michigan-based economist who studies how local and state policies impact economic development. Let's go back to the phones now with Don joining us from Madison. Hi, Don.
Hi.
What's on your mind here?
I just wanted to add something to a prior call, very important point that was made that your guest addressed, which has to do with the long-term viability of a business and whether a worker is going to, you know, invest time and money into training when they know or suspect that the job's going to be eliminated in a decade or two. What impact does automation have on that, the thinking that, you know, the worker or ought to have on the thinking that the worker puts into it, meaning that I think a lot of people believe that the reason or one reason it's limited is because they'll eventually be replaced by a robot.
Don, thank you for the call. Tim Bartik, what do we know about automation and its impact?
Well, automation is going to mean over time that some jobs in manufacturing are going to go away and be replaced by robots. That doesn't mean that all the jobs go away. Someone needs to monitor the robots. Someone needs to design the robots. Someone needs to reprogram them. And there are jobs, of course, that can't be roboticized. And there are things that occur that when things go awry, someone needs to correct it. So it doesn't mean all the jobs go away. It actually, though, does mean that the U.S. could be more competitive because the remaining jobs require more skills, and the U.S. is a relatively skills-intensive economy. So in the long term, I think it means fewer jobs, more highly skilled jobs, and jobs in which the U.S. will be more competitive.
Tim, is there really any way of telling what types of manufacturing jobs have longevity over decades, over a career? Or can we really predict technology changes like that and how workers will need to evolve?
Well, we can and we can't. I mean, we can to some extent. I mean, if you want to, you can download all kinds of predictions from Bureau of Labor Statistics for what they think is going to happen to different occupations over time. But, you know, to be honest, that involves a lot of guesswork. I think it was Yogi Berra who said predictions are hard, especially about the future. You know, because we don't know how rapidly these technologies will develop. I mean, how rapidly will autonomous vehicles take off? We don't know exactly. I mean, there could be technical glitches that prevent them from being as widely used as we might currently think. Same is true with robots. We know that robots are able to do more and more things, but they may not advance as rapidly as people think. So I think there's always going to be some uncertainty there. What you hope is for a government policy that says we do want to be competitive in manufacturing. We don't necessarily want to cling to every old industry or old job, especially if it doesn't make sense, but we want to be committed to the U.S. being a strong presence in manufacturing over the long term. And I think with an overall government policy that was committed to that, it would provide a little more assurance to both workers and businesses, that they could make long-term investments that would pay off. So I don't think you can eliminate uncertainty, but you can limit it a little bit with the right government policies.
Well, let's pretend, Tim Bartik, that you are heading up Wisconsin's economic development. You've got a job change. How would you go about encouraging manufacturers to come to or to stay in Wisconsin?
Well, I would focus more on how I could make an environment where manufacturing more competitive, and I would focus on trying to create an environment, trying to help manufacturers be more competitive. In other words, rather than saying, how can I entice manufacturers to come to Wisconsin, I would say, look, I already have a base of manufacturers in Wisconsin. I have a whole variety of large companies, small and medium-sized companies. Let's talk to them and find out what their problems and issues are and see what we can do to help address them. And in particular, I think that government has a stronger role to play with small and medium-sized manufacturers. Small and medium-sized manufacturers don't necessarily have all the information they need. They maybe can't afford to run their own training programs. They may need more government assistance with training. They may have more financing issues that government can provide some assistance with. They may have less information about how to get various permits or how to deal with different issues. So I would really focus in on my small and medium-sized manufacturing sector, and I would focus on making sure that my technical college system was working on an ongoing basis in a high-quality way with those manufacturers. And I would be bringing together manufacturers, particularly from related industries, and seeing if they had common concerns that maybe Wisconsin state and local government could address.
Well, let's circle back to Kohler here for a moment. Its decision will impact about 325 employees to move to Hattiesburg. The company has said it will make available alternative jobs here in Wisconsin for those workers. What is your reaction to that approach?
Well, that's certainly very good for those workers, because if they were going to be laid off, I mean, the reality is if you get laid off, particularly if you're an older worker from a good job, there are a lot of studies showing that that has very strong negative effects on your long-run earnings. So worker displacement is a real issue in the U.S. When someone in their 40s loses a long-term job they've had for many years, they may eventually recover from that, but there tends to be lost earnings that they never fully recover from.
When companies have been embedded in a community for decades, they become part of the identity of that area and the people who live there. Have you found any evidence that suggests that governments feel more pressure to keep these companies from moving or from consolidating, or more pressure to incentivize them to keep doing what they're doing?
Well, company, to be honest with you, the main pressure seems to be the larger the company, the more inclined government seems to be to want to offer incentives, whether it's an existing company or a new company. I mean, witness the competition for Amazon, the most recent case, where all kinds of places that had no particular prior ties to Amazon offered very hefty incentives. I think New Jersey was over $7 billion. For example, Maryland was like over $7 billion. They had no particular prior ties to Amazon. So I really think it's the large companies. What governors seem to want to do is to offer very large incentives to large companies that they know are going to attract a lot of media attention. And particularly if you can offer long-term incentives that the next governor will have to pay for, it's a very politically attractive proposition. I think the main bias in economic development policy is a bias towards large companies. And if I were an economic development policymaker, I'd be trying to overcome that bias and focus more on the small and medium-sized companies that are really the basis of your economy.
Tim, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Tim Bartik is a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And we invited the Kohler Company to join us for this discussion. They were unable to, but offered this statement. Kohler Engines has manufactured gasoline engines primarily for consumer ride-on lawnmowers in Hattiesburg since 1998. In addition to these models, the Hattiesburg facility will be manufacturing commercial gasoline engines for equipment used in the lawn and garden construction markets. On September 30th, 2018, Kohler Engines and the UAW Local 833 reached agreement to move forward with the consolidation of Kohler Engines' U.S.-based manufacturing operations in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. This consolidation created a simplified customer experience and is not about reducing headcount or downsizing the business. As part of the agreement, we will make available alternative jobs in Wisconsin for all the affected associates. We remain fully committed to our headquarters in Wisconsin, where we are continuing to invest in our facilities and actively recruiting for a wide range of roles, end quote. You're listening to the Ideas Network.